Hello and welcome to this UK Defence Club podcast. My name is Laura Starr and I am a Senior Claims Director at the club.
And I am Philippa Langton, also a Senior Claims Director at the club. And in this podcast, Laura and I will be discussing some of the common issues that arise in the context of LNG charter parties.
Although charter party disputes may be less common in the LNG trade than in other trades, when they do arise, they can be complicated and costly. It also seems that these disputes are gently on the rise. This could be partly due to the trend towards shorter-term spot charters, which may not generate the same commercial relationship between owner and charterer as the long-term charters traditionally seen in the world of LNG. Another reason may be the ever-increasing complexity of LNG ships and their onboard technology, which inevitably means there is more scope for things to go wrong. The high hire rates attached to LNG ships mean that even short delays are potentially expensive. So together, these facts are a recipe for dispute. Whatever the reason may be, in this growing industry, it is important to be alive to the potential areas of dispute and minimise them where possible by careful drafting and understanding of the relevant charter terms.
Of course, conventional charter terms used in other trades can't readily be used for the charter of an LNG carrier. Charter terms must be specific to LNG carriage and its special features. Although it's not unusual for parties to negotiate bespoke terms, the most commonly used standard terms are, of course, the Shell LNG Time 1 and 2 and the LNG Voy Charter. So we will focus our analysis on those standard terms today. So in this podcast, Laura and I are going to take a look at three of the main areas where the Defence Club has seen a trend for charter party disputes in an LNG context. And those are underperformance claims, breakdowns and maintenance issues, and thirdly, terminal compatibility and acceptance. We're going to discuss each of these in turn, and Laura is going to start by talking about performance claims first.
A particular feature of LNG ships is their ability to use cargo boil-off as fuel in dual-fuel engines. The ability to use different fuels is highly advantageous. It provides a flexibility which can be used to minimise operating costs. That is, of course, a positive development. However, it brings with it new challenges for owners, as charterers become ever more demanding in terms of flexibility and the use of boil-off to increase efficiency. It is therefore readily accepted that claims relating to a ship's performance are typically more complex in the LNG trade than in other trades due to the need to factor in boil-off. In a conventional shipping context, there are two quite distinct types of claim which do not overlap with each other: cargo shortage claims and performance or overconsumption claims. In an LNG context, however, the sharp line between those two types of claim becomes blurred because LNG is both a cargo and a fuel. For the most part, it is a cargo, but it is fuel when used in the form of boil-off to power the ship's engines. As a result, an LNG time charter form needs to address, among many other things, two interrelated matters. Firstly, the circumstances in which there will be a valid shortage claim, bearing in mind that some LNG may have been deliberately boiled off for use as fuel, used for cooling down lines prior to cargo operations, and also that some boil-off is inevitable. And secondly, the circumstances in which there will be a valid performance claim in the sense of overconsumption of fuel, bearing in mind that two types of fuels are involved, regular fuel and the LNG itself. The Shell LNG Time 1 form, by way of example, contains detailed terms concerning performance in Appendix C. In brief summary, it addresses the two matters just described in the following five key ways. First, there is the concept of fuel oil equivalent. This is essentially a conversion factor which allows one to say that X cubic metres of LNG cargo corresponds to Y tonnes of fuel oil. This enables a more straightforward comparison between the volume of LNG lost as boil-off and the consumption of fuel oil. Secondly, there is a maximum allowed consumption expressed in terms of fuel oil equivalent. This provides, subject to the exclusion mentioned in the fourth point to follow, for the actual consumption of the ship to be assessed as the sum of 1. Regular bunkers consumed, and 2. The cargo lost as boil off. So, subject to the exclusion, cargo lost as boil off is treated as having been consumed in the ship's engines or burned in the GCU. Thirdly, Shell LNG time 1 provides for an agreed maximum amount of permitted boil off. The charter will have a claim if more LNG is lost by way of boil off than that stipulated maximum. This is, however, subject to an important qualification. The maximum is deemed to be complied with if the charterer gives orders that result in an increased volume of boil off. This makes explicit that which would probably be implicit anyway. If the charterer takes advantage of the ship's ability to use boil off and requires boil off to be generated for that purpose, known as forced boil off, it cannot expect to have a claim based on the maximum being exceeded. Fourthly, if there is any amount of boil off in excess of the maximum permitted boil off, that excess amount is not included in the calculation of consumption. This addresses the categorisation and double counting issues that would otherwise arise. Excessive boil off could be categorised as either a consumption claim or as a shortage claim, but it cannot sensibly be both simultaneously, otherwise that would be double counting. Excluding excess boil off from the consumption calculations in this way means that any claim by a charterer in respect of the excess is effectively treated as a shortage claim and cannot feature in any performance or overconsumption claim. Fifthly, subject to the other terms of the charter, the owner has free use of all boil off. Because this free use is subject to the other terms, it does not affect the owner's obligations in relation to maximum boil-off and maximum consumption. It does mean, however, that boil-off can be used without penalty and to the owner's advantage if those obligations are complied with. Aside from those points, Appendix C also includes a minimum speed requirement, that is, a speed at which the ship must be capable of steaming whilst at the same time complying with the obligations as to maximum consumption and boil-off. I am now going to discuss three brief illustrations of how the additional contractual and technological complexity in LNG charters can throw up questions not necessarily answered clearly by the standard charter forms. Firstly, let's consider the issue that arises where the maximum boil-off is exceeded. Suppose that the charterer gives orders that result in increased boil-off so that, as mentioned earlier, they cannot then complain that the maximum permitted boil-off is exceeded. However, it may be the case that the ship is generally inefficient, so that there is more boil-off and more consumption than there should be. In that situation, it seems the charterer can't make a shortage claim based on the maximum boil-off because, by reason of the charterer having ordered the ship to use boil-off, the maximum limit is deemed to have been complied with. Is the charterer then prevented from treating it as an overconsumption claim instead because of the double counting exclusion I mentioned in the fourth point earlier? There are two ways of looking at this. The owner can say that, simply as a matter of fact or arithmetic, there was boil-off in excess of the figure stipulated as the maximum, and then argue on that basis that the excess has to be ignored when it comes to calculating consumption because of the exclusion I mentioned. The charterer, by contrast, might argue that the exclusion is simply intended to avoid double counting, and it becomes irrelevant where the boil-off maximum has been complied with, including the case of deemed compliance. In that case, as there can be no shortage claim, the total amount of boil-off, including the excess, should be included in the ship's calculation of consumption. As a second example, we will see that the method for calculating consumption and boil-off can give rise to complications. Appendix C of Shell LNG Time 1 sets out a methodology for calculating fuel consumption and boil-off in order to establish whether there has been overconsumption. While those provisions are important, their complexity can lead to confusion and, in turn, inaccurate performance claims by a charterer. For example, Article 2A1 of Appendix C to Shell LNG Time 1 defines the term sea passage as meaning the shortest safe route to the named port measured from pilot station to pilot station. Article 8A of Appendix C then provides that the boil-off excess or saving on any sea passage shall be calculated by comparing the guaranteed boil-off for the sea passage, i.e. the daily guaranteed maximum boil-off multiplied by the time between gaugings, with the actual boil-off. Crucially, the words sea passage in Article 8 are not capitalised, and yet they are in Article 2. So, for the purposes of the boil-off calculation under Article 8, sea passage arguably means the total period between gaugings. That is different under Article 2, and this difference in definitions may seem insignificant, but applying the wrong definition could result in an inflated boil-off claim against the owner. An owner should review any excess boil-off claim carefully to check that the calculations are based on the correct temporal period. In contrast to that boil-off calculation methodology, the approach to assessing fuel consumption is based on a voyage, defined as starting when the ship proceeds full away on passage from her departure point and ending at the time the ship records end of passage on arrival. Again, these discrete differences can catch an owner or charterer out, and so their correct application should be checked for each claim. The third example of where issues can arise is with a ship's inability to meet warranties due to design or technical deficiencies. In cases where the ship regularly has to consume more fuel oil and or boil off than is permitted under the charter terms in order to maintain the required minimum speed, it may transpire that she is physically unable to meet the warranties. The performance warranties in the charter would likely have been based on the ship's design criteria and the results of sea trials. If the ship cannot perform in line with those warranties, this may point to a technical or design problem with the ship. The owner should, amongst other things, consider its position as against the shipyard at which the ship was designed and built. It may be that the owner can bring a claim against the yard to compensate it for the damages it has to pay to the charterer. The viability of this type of claim will depend on the terms of the shipbuilding contract, but contracts of this nature frequently restrict compensation for failure to meet such performance criteria solely to an agreed rate of liquidated damages, thereby removing or limiting an owner's ability to claim for their actual losses arising from such delays. An alternative consideration for the owner is the extent to which the charterer was involved in the design and construction of the ship. In long-term charters, the charterer is sometimes closely involved and indeed receives the design for approval in advance. The problem which causes the ship not to be able to meet her performance criteria may arise from a fundamental design flaw which was overlooked by all parties during the design and construction phase. In this instance, it is possible that the ship was never going to be able to meet the performance warranties and that the parties had accordingly agreed the charter terms under an incorrect assumption as to the ship's capabilities. The owner may wish to consider whether the doctrine of common mistake could be relied upon in this scenario to rectify the performance warranties so as to reflect the ship's actual capability. Again, this would require careful consideration as appropriate on the facts of the case.
Well, thank you, Laura, for that in-depth look at some of the complexities that can clearly arise in relation to performance claims in an LNG context. And now I'm going to have a look at the breakdown and maintenance obligations under LNG charter parties and the disputes that we are commonly seeing thereunder. Of course, the LNG industry has a strong track record for operational safety, but inevitably breakdown and maintenance issues can and do arise, even if they don't ultimately compromise the safety of the ship. When dealing with such issues, Parties should analyse the owner's obligations as to maintenance under the charter party and whether there are any off-hire consequences in relation to the technical problem that has arisen. Over the past few years, the club has seen a catalogue of technical issues, some examples of which include failure of reliquefaction systems, breakdown of low duty compressors, inaccuracy of measurements in the drive measurement chains, failed vacuum pumps, damaged companders, lube oil cooler breakdowns, leaks in engine hydraulic systems, and defects in stern tube seals, to name but a few. There doesn't presently seem to be any clear pattern emerging, from our experience, indicating perhaps that issues are arising merely because LNG carriers are technologically complex ships, rather than through any particular difficulty, for example, with specific designs or yards. LNG technology is also constantly evolving, bringing with it new fuel types, engines and gas management equipment, and in turn inevitable teething problems. Coupled with relatively high hire rates, which can mean a lot is at stake for even a minor delay to trade, there's a clear potential for such disputes to continue. The starting point in any such dispute is to assess the scope of the owner's maintenance obligations. As an example, Clause 1 of the Shell LNG Time form requires the owner to deliver the ship in a seaworthy condition. This is an absolute obligation, but despite the inclusion of the words throughout the charter period in the opening line of that clause, it is not thought that that absolute obligation as to seaworthiness continues beyond delivery. Rather, after delivery, the relevant obligation on the owner as to maintenance is then to be found in Clause 3. Clause 3 imposes an obligation of due diligence on the owner as regards maintenance, together with a positive obligation to take steps to restore and maintain the condition of the ship as it was on delivery. Clause 2b of the LNG VOI form is in similar terms, imposing the standard obligation of due diligence throughout the currency of the charter party to ensure that the ship is tight, staunch, strong and in good order and condition, with machinery and equipment in good and efficient state, and in every way fit for its voyage and trade. The explicit reference to the due diligence obligation that subsists throughout the charter party avoids any debate as to the start or end point of the owner's obligation. But in contrast to the Shell LNG Time form, there's no express obligation to restore the ship to the condition it was in on delivery. Of course, it's open to the parties to amend these standard provisions, and we have seen bespoke variations on that wording. In the event of a breakdown, following which a charterer alleges a breach by the owner of the maintenance obligation, the owner will only be in breach under the standard form charters I've just mentioned if there's been a failure to exercise due diligence. The first step for the owner, therefore, is to assess whether due diligence was in fact exercised, such that the owner will be able to mount a defence. This concept of due diligence is not unique to LNG charters, of course. Clause 3 of the Shell LNG Time 1, for example, is largely a reflection of the maintenance provisions in Clause 3 of Shell Time 4. So the scope of the due diligence obligation should be familiar to many listeners, and I won't go into further detail here. So what then if the owner is in breach of the due diligence obligation? Well, under the Shell LNG Time 1 terms, if that's the case, the charterer may then look to Clauses 3 and or 22. Under Clause 3c, the charterer has to give the owner written notice of the breach, and if, after expiry of a fixed period, the owner has failed to demonstrate to the charterer's reasonable satisfaction that they've exercised due diligence, the ship will be off hire until the owner has demonstrated that they are using due diligence. There doesn't appear to be any requirement that the owner's breach has led to any interruption of service, or reduction in performance or loss of time. So there's a possibility, pursuant to this provision, that the ship could be placed off hire for a very minor breach of a maintenance obligation, which in fact has no material impact on performance. Furthermore, at any time the ship is off hire under this provision, the charterer can terminate the charter pursuant to Clause 3f. So, even though the charterer may have had uninterrupted use of the ship, the owner can find that it's not entitled to hire and, worse still, that the charterer can terminate the charter due to a potentially minor lapse in due diligence. The owner may be likely to contest such an outcome vigorously, but the charterer's response will necessarily be that the dangerous nature of the LNG trade, which necessitates the highest standards of maintenance at all times, justifies the imposition of this extremely stringent term on the owner. Furthermore, under the Shell LNG Time 2, in the event of the charter being for a single voyage only, the ship can be placed off hire immediately upon notice to the owner of the alleged failure, and indeed the charterer can proceed to terminate the charter at that point. There's no requirement for a rectification period for the owner to make good their alleged want of due diligence. So for this reason, owners should be very wary indeed about using the Shell LNG Time 2 in unamended form, at least when dealing with a single trip charter. Aside from Clause 3, as I mentioned earlier, the charterer can also look to Clause 22, the off-hire clause. In contrast to the off-hire situation under Clause 3C, Clause 22A is very much in line with the off-hire clauses in other charters, such as Shell Time 4. A ship can be placed off-hire due to delays caused by matters such as breakdown of equipment, deficiency of stores, hull or machinery difficulties, and also routine maintenance work or accidental damages. And Clause 22 also makes specific provision for certain technical LNG issues, such as the LNG boil-off during off-hire periods, and time lost in relation to tank cooling. If, as a result of a maintenance-related off-hire event, such as an equipment failure, the ship is able to proceed but fails to meet its guaranteed speed, the charterer has two alternative options. It can place the ship off-hire, either under Clause 22B or under Appendix C. It can't do both. The differing off-hire calculations under each of those separate provisions will dictate how the charterer approaches its claim in that situation. Under Clause 22, as opposed to the Maintenance Clause 3, there's a requirement that there be a loss of time exceeding a certain minimum threshold. This means that the owner's maintenance obligations and alleged breach thereof have different consequences depending on whether the breach is alleged as a failure of due diligence in maintenance with notification having been given by the charterer, or, on the other hand, whether it's a failure of maintenance which has resulted in a loss of time, even without notification of the charterer. The notified failure, which the owner has on this scenario failed to rectify, can trigger off-hire even if there's no loss of time, but on the other hand, a non-notified failure appears to require loss of time within the parameters set by the off-hire clause 22. Under the LNG VOI form, time lost due to ship-related matters such as breakdowns and repairs will inevitably not count as laytime or demurrage. That's pursuant to the laytime provisions in Clause 17A. And further, Clause 23 makes provision for how to deal with boil-off in such circumstances. And finally, it's worth noting that the charterer's right to place the ship off hire or terminate the charter for a breach of maintenance are not exclusive remedies. If the charterer has suffered other losses as a result of the breach, for example, a lost subfixture, the charterer may well have a claim in damages for those losses as well. This applies to both time and voyage charters. But of course, the charterer would need to tackle the usual issues of causation and remoteness of damages. And it may also be necessary to consider the inclusion of any clauses purporting to exclude consequential losses. The crux of such disputes in terms of allocating liability will be to establish what the technical issue is and what has caused it. So that concludes my quick canter through LNG maintenance obligations. And now I'll hand back over to Laura to look at our third topic, which is terminal compatibility and acceptance.
Terminal compatibility and acceptance is an issue that to date has received relatively little attention in published case law, and yet certainly has potential to give rise to dispute. Given the highly technical nature of LNG operations, it is of fundamental importance that the ship is technically compatible with and acceptable to the terminals to which it is intended to trade. The main standard form LNG charters contain provisions for terminal compatibility and acceptance. However, there are some important differences between the clauses across the charter forms. In Shell LNG Time 1, under Clause 4D, owners warrant that the vessel is compatible with the LNG terminals that are listed in Appendix A for berthing, unberthing, loading and discharging. This is taken to be a warranty of technical compatibility with the terminals listed. It is largely within the owner's control, it being possible to ascertain at the outset whether the ship is technically compatible with the LNG terminal. Nevertheless, problems arise in practice where, for example, terminals undergo structural changes or amend their safety regulations subsequent to the building of the ship or entering into the charter party, or where a terminal has two jetties or berths, only one of which can accommodate the ship. It is difficult for an owner to argue with a terminal's decision on compatibility. When problems of non-compatibility arise, therefore, a careful assessment is needed to ascertain which party under the charter has accepted the contractual risk. Crucially, to determine whether the owner will be in breach of the charter party for non-compatibility or not. In some cases, the charterer is closely involved in the design and construction of the ship from the outset, as it has committed to take the ship on a long-term charter once built. The charter form may even require the owner to obtain the charterer's approval of the ship's design, so the ship must be built to a design acceptable to the charterer and at the same time be compatible with the given list of terminals. Yet it is plausible that the ship's design is such that the ship was never going to be compatible with one or more of the listed terminals, and that the parties overlook this by mistake when the design is produced. In this instance, it may be that neither party is liable for the inevitable future rejection of the ship by the terminal, but instead that the doctrine of common mistake could be relied upon to rectify the list of intended terminals in the charter. Again, this would require careful consideration as appropriate on the facts of the case. Similar issues may arise in relation to the LNG Voy charter form. This charter also requires compatibility with the terminal, but goes a step further by providing a due diligence obligation that the ship be acceptable to the terminal. Clause 2 provides that the owner's warrant the vessel will be compatible, and secondly, that the owner shall exercise due diligence to ensure that the vessel will be accepted by the terminals before and at the commencement of the voyage. This is a much broader obligation and must be interpreted to add a further duty on the owner over and above the warranty of technical compatibility. Whilst technical compatibility may frequently be a factual issue, this concept of acceptability is significantly broader and offers scope for interpretation and argument. The obligation may be tempered by being one of due diligence only, but it nevertheless creates a significant liability risk for the owner. It imposes a potentially unpredictable and onerous burden on the owner. What is acceptable to a terminal could be varied without notice, and could even be dependent on business conditions outside the party's knowledge at a particular time. Charter parties may also have bespoke provisions, such as warranties of commercial and technical acceptance, which can create further ambiguity. What then are the consequences of non-compatibility or rejection? If, despite the matters just discussed, the owner is in breach of the charter in relation to terminal acceptance and/or compatibility, the standard form charters do not provide a regime to address this. The obvious course for a disgruntled charterer would be to seek damages for breach of the provision. Given the high value of LNG cargoes and likelihood of onward sales with particular timetables, the owner could be exposed to significant claims. There appear to be no reported cases directly on point arising from the standard LNG charter forms. However, analogies can be drawn with other cases. There have been a number of older cases considering the concept of terminal acceptance within contracts for the sale and purchase of oil rather than in the charter itself. For example, in the Honam Jade, the Court of Appeal considered the status of a term that nomination of a ship in a sale and purchase of oil be subject to terminal acceptance. The Court of Appeal found that this was, in the context, an innominate term, meaning that the consequences of breaching it will depend on the severity of the breach. Where a breach of an innominate term is considered to deprive the innocent party of substantially the whole benefit of the contract, the innocent party may terminate the contract. In this case, the consequences of the owner's failure to comply with the term in a timely fashion was considered sufficient to justify the buyer in cancelling the contract. The claimant was awarded its loss of profits on the sale and an indemnity against claims arising from lost sub-sales. Whilst there have been many developments in the law of damages since 1991, when the Honam case was considered, the fact remains that there is a high potential exposure for an owner should they fail to provide a ship that is acceptable to the terminal. When we say terminal acceptance, this means acceptance by the terminal, and it is not for the parties to preempt whether or not the terminal will accept. Otherwise, the party will risk being in breach of contract themselves for wrongful rejection of the ship. In the case of SK Shipping against BB Energy Asia Limited in 1999, in a sale and purchase of gas oil, the seller announced that a ship was not acceptable to the terminal because it believed that the terminal would not be able to permit loading at the relevant time. However, the seller had not in fact confirmed this with the terminal itself. The seller was held to be in breach of contract and liable for damages as a result. They were not entitled to substitute their view for that of the terminal.
And so that concludes our discussion of the three key areas where we at the club commonly see disputes in relation to LNG charters. Unfortunately, there has been little consideration in case law of the issues we've covered today. Standard contracts specific to the LNG trade are comparatively recent and haven't yet generated a substantial body of jurisprudence. So there is scope for argument, both from first principles and by analogy with other cases, as and when disputes do arise.
As ever in contractual matters, any dispute will require a close consideration of the particular words used in the relevant contract, and the answer will usually depend on precisely how those words are interpreted. In that respect, LNG carriage and the dispute to which it gives rise are entirely conventional, yet the complexity of the LNG ship itself and the relative paucity of case law surrounding the standard LNG forms of charter set the scene for difficulties to arise. As the LNG trade grows, it is expected that there may be an increase in disputes relating to the issues discussed in this podcast. We hope you have found this podcast useful and informative. Please do contact us if you have any questions in relation to the issues we have discussed.